was but a cover story. From that highly improbable account of a gentle rabbi, friend of little children, Roman tax collectors, and ladies with gynecological problems, could be distilled by skilled interpreters, well versed in the art of rabbinic exegesis, as well as the abracadabra of Gnostic mysticism, secret passwords and sayings, the formulae for medicaments and hallucinatory drugs, the therapia in practice and prescription, which had earned them their reputation and name of Asaya Essenes, physicians.
The mushroom, the sacred mushroom.
Suggesting that Jesus Christ was a mushroom?
Put pretty blankly, yes.
Surely you don't suggest that Jesus Christ and his various disciples were not human creatures?
Yes. You are dealing with a secret cult, a secret society. The stories of the New Testament contain certain incantations, certain magic names, which were really the names of mushrooms.
No, but the writers, Matthew, Mark, Luke, John, these men who wrote the story, you are telling me they did not exist?
No.
None of them exist.
It's part of mythology. It's part of mushroom mythology.
That was Mushroom Jesus DNA by Slightly Evolved. And this is Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast, episode number 122. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. This episode is an interview with Professor Carl Ruck, titled Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, the Drug Cult That Civilized Europe, and is being released on Friday, September 23, 2011. My interview with Carl was recorded on September 22, 2011. Today, Carl is back for his third interview with us to discuss his explosive new book, Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, The Drug Cult That Civilized Europe. Carl A.P. Ruck is professor of classics at Boston University, an authority on the ecstatic rituals of the god Dionysus. With the ethnomycologist R. Gordon Wasson and Albert Hofmann, the inventor of LSD, he identified the secret psychoactive ingredient in the visionary potion that was drunk by the initiates at the Eleusinian Mystery. In Persephone's Quest, Entheogens and the Origins of Religion, he proclaimed the centrality of the psychoactive sacraments at the very beginnings of religion, employing the neologism entheogen to free the topic from the pejorative connotations for words like drug or hallucinogen. Carl's publications include IG 2 Second 2322, The List of Vicars in the Comedy at the Dionysia, 1967, and Pindar's Selected Odes, 1967 as well, and The Road to Ulysses, Unveiling the Secret of the Mysteries, and that was published in 1978 with R. Gordon Wasson, Albert Hofmann, and Blaise Staples, and also Persephone's Quest, Entheogens and the Origins of Religion, 1986 with R. Gordon Wasson, Stella Kramrich, and Jonathan Ott. He also published The World of Classical Myth, Gods and Goddesses, Heroines and Heroes in 1994, and Intensive Latin, for those who need to study your Latin, in 1997, and his Apples of Apollo, Pagan and Christian Mysteries of the Eucharist, with Clark Heinrich and Blaise Staples in 2000, and Ancient Greek, Intensive Review and Reference, 2001, and then Sacred Mushrooms of the Goddess, Secrets of Ulysses in 2006, and we had him on last time for his book, The Hidden World, Survival of Pagan Shamanic Themes in European Fairy Tales, that was published in 2007, and he also published Fungus Redivivus, New Light on the Mushroom Controversy, And he published that in the 40th anniversary edition of John Marco Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross that I republished in 2009, as well as Mushrooms, Myth, and Mithras, his newest, and his next book will be The Influence of Deity, Alchemy and the Psychoactive Sacraments in Medieval and Renaissance Art, and that's scheduled for 2012. And donations. This episode is dedicated to Mark, Jeremy, Arthur, Jeremy 2, Stephen, Bew, and John. The show is run on donations and our website sales. This is not corporate media, but independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by donating or ordering one of the books or DVDs or the audio archives or getting a membership or checking out the new t-shirts up on the website, etc., you help to continue this programming. And we ask that you stop sending your money every month to your cable company, paying the corporate media to lie to you every day on the television, and instead invest in your and everyone else's edification by donating to shows like this and making interviews like these happen. And not just here, but for all quality independent media. And upcoming shows next week, it looks like Daniela Martin from Girl Meets Bug will be here. And I'm still trying to get other interviews set up after that. And it depends on how much study I can accomplish in the meantime. And again, support this program by going to the Gnostic Media website and ordering some of the stuff off the website to help support this program. We greatly appreciate it. The views expressed by the authors and guests of this unprogram are their own and are not necessarily those held by myself, the host, or Gnostic Media. And you can check out the Gnostic Media website at www.gnosticmedia.com, and you can contact me directly at contact@gnosticmedia.com or through the contact form on the website. And thanks for listening, and thank you for your support. And here is my interview with Professor Carl Ruck. Enjoy. Carl, welcome back to the show for your third time. Why don't you start off by telling the audience a little bit about yourself and your primary focus of research for the last 30-plus years?
Well, it's a long story. I'm not sure where to start, but it has to do with the belief that the primordial religious experience is caused by the ingestion of a psychoactive sacrament. And most recently, we studied a cave painting, not actually a cave painting, it's a rock face, a rock shelter, in southern Spain, in a forest called Selva Pascuala. And it's a very, very interesting site. It has a bull's head. The rock face has a natural impression of a bull, and that's been painted to pull it out. Then it's been used over and over again, and so there are doodlings and other things. You can't tell how much of it's supposed to go together. But very clearly, on the lower right, is a line of things that look like dancing mushrooms. And so we interpret them as a particular species of mushroom. The thing is that people have speculated that cave paintings or prehistoric art had something to do with drug use, but it's never been accepted by the academic establishment. And with a great deal of rewriting and so forth, we got this paper published in a peer-reviewed journal, and so it's caused a lot of interest, and a lot of people are very angry about it. So anyway, I have a PhD in classics. I started out training to be first a medical doctor and then a psychiatrist, but I got wooed by ancient languages, and so.
Well, you know, I've known you for quite a while, and that's something that I never knew about you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, that's why I'm so interdisciplinary. And so I have degrees from Yale and University of Michigan and Harvard. And I've done really
hard. Where did you get your PhD from?
From Harvard. And I've done really technical things in my field. And so I really have established that I'm not stupid, in addition to where I went to school. But for a long time, people have just decided that what I do is too fringe to pay any attention to. Well, you know, the program last night, History Channel, it it had a parental guidance disclaimer, you know, which usually means that, you know, it has obscenity and nudity. And it's just that it had to do with drugs. And there was nothing at all, you know, exciting, inciting the use of drugs. In fact, it was very balanced presentation. And a good half of it dealt with the opium war and drug use amongst the intelligentsia at the end of the 19th century. And then our prohibition of alcohol and how that failed, and the disaster of our present war on drugs, and the fact that the pharmaceutical industry, as a matter of fact, makes a fortune by convincing us that we have certain ailments and then producing a drug that we can become addicted to that makes us think that we've gotten rid of that symptom. So we're really addicted to drugs. And the illegal drug trade is only part of it.
Mushrooms, Myth and Mithras, the drug cult that civilized Europe. What brought you to give your new book that title?
Well, first of all, you know, when you title a book, you have to have key words that are going to come up on a Google search. And so if you're interested in myths, if you're interested in Mithras or mushrooms, eventually you're going to come up with that. The second part was the shocking part, because it, of course, is facetious, because Europe was very well civilized before it became part of the Roman Empire. And in fact, the Roman Empire destroyed many indigenous or earlier cultures. And so many people think that Europe became civilized because it became part of the Roman Empire. But what it really has to do with is the fact that the people who administered the Roman Empire, the emperor himself and his bureaucrats, and in particular his army, they were all, or for the most part, all initiated into this brotherhood. And it involved 7 stages of initiation. There must be something new at each stage, so it's hard to tell exactly what was done, although we try to reconstruct that. But it has to do essentially with the symbolism of a sacred mushroom. Doesn't mean they had a mushroom at every stage of the initiation, but that certainly seems to be the goal of the 7 steps. So, many people are very angry about the fact that that paganism is a pejorative term. And all it means is it's the people who were not totally...
Yeah, it means it's from Latin paganus, which just means rural, doesn't it?
It means rural, yes, the country people. And
yes.
So it's where the government, and when finally the empire was converted to Christianity, it's where they couldn't completely exert their control. As we all know, Christianity and all religions assimilate earlier traditions. And so,
most people would be furious by your statement of that, but I fully agree with you.
Yeah.
So why have you decided to be the first to publish the ancient Mithraic mysteries?
Well, you know, the book has been in preparation for 10 years. It's amazing how long, and essentially, you know, the argument was complete 10 years ago, but and then we made it longer, and then it got cut down shorter in order to fit into an inexpensive edition such as the City Lights version. So there was more to it, but this is the essential part of it. And so the leftover pieces that we can present elsewhere.
All right. You start off your book basically discussing the First Supper. Talk about the First Supper and how does it relate to both Mithraism as well as Christianity?
Well, the documentary in the History Channel used Kenneth McKenna's theory of early man, hominid, having a drug experience and changing the nature of their thought. And so it's called Stoned Apes. And what was your question after that?
How does the First Supper relate?
Oh, yes. Well, that's the First Supper. the Last Supper is, of course, the tradition of Christ's Last Supper. But there was a First Supper as well. The first supper in the Bible is the tree in Eden, Adam and Eve. But in actual historical event, it would have been enacted many places in early history where some leader of the tribe, by ingesting something special, had a visionary experience which changed the nature of the way he or she thought about the relationship of life to other dimensions.
There's been a long and ongoing debate between meditation and the use of entheogens for spiritual purposes. Would you please tell the audience where the word meditate is derived?
Well, I haven't thought about it, but...
But it's actually, you do have it in your book.
Yeah, I think it has to do with bridging opposite polarities.
And the root is the same as medicate.
Oh, I think I did say that. Yes.
Yeah, I took that straight out of your book. So
yeah. Well, what a medicine does is exactly that. And so meditate isn't really related to medicine, but medicine and meditate are related to the same idea.
What is the core root there?
I think it has to do with middle.
Middle. Interesting. So it's you're mediating between the heaven and the earth, or the heavens,
yes,
and yourself. Is that the idea?
Life and death, sickness and health.
So whether you did it by meditation or medication, the effect was essentially the same, to get in the middle.
Yeah, or cross over the middle. The middle is where one world ends and the other begins. And so in ritual of initiation, you pass through that middle and enter into another realm. It's the barrier, the membrane separating this reality from another.
Which is depicted in much of the alchemical artwork and the like. There's one famous painting that I can't remember the name of that very well depicts that.
Mm-hmm.
How was shamanism at the heart of Greek philosophy?
Philosopher was the term that Plato made up in order to separate Socrates from the other people who were doing the similar things, and they were wise people, sophists. And we know that in Spanish, a sabio or a sabia is a shaman, a wise person, a healer, and so forth. So we have ample evidence that there were philosophers, Plato's term, for people who were sophists in classical antiquity. We also have ample evidence that many of these philosophies, especially those classified as Neoplatonic, taken off a bit further from where Plato stopped, that they were visionary. And it's simply that what we've been calling philosophers were shamans.
When did the word sophist, when did it switch from being considered wisdom and wise people into the liars of Demosthenes?
Well, you know, the distinction that Plato makes between a sophist and a philosopher, using Socrates as his model, and of course we don't really know that Plato isn't making up a good deal about Socrates, because there are other versions of Socrates from other sources. But the big distinction he makes is that a philosopher makes a living by charging for what he or she does. And we all know that Socrates was impoverished. He never charged anything because he never thought he had anything he could sell. All he had, according to Plato, is the knowledge that he didn't know anything.
Wow, interesting. In your opinion, do Mithraism and Christianity share many similarities?
It's really amazing how similar they are. Yeah. And
why do you suppose that so many people are adamant that there are no similarities between Mithraism and Christianity?
Well, it's because Christ is a god, and he wasn't a god for the first couple hundred years of Christianity. He was like Moses, and like Abraham, and like Muhammad, and like Buddha. He was a prophet. But when Christ became a god, which was a difficult thing to do because there's only one god, so how do you make one god have room for him? That meant that all of the other philosophies and religions were wrong because they didn't have Christ as their god. They had Yahweh as their god or something equivalent to it, but they didn't have Christ as their god. Christianity and Mithraism are similar because they come from the same religious source.
And what is that?
Well, it's quite possible that the original monotheistic religion was Zoroastrianism, and we know that there are many Zoroastrians. That's just the name for the person who's the priest in that religious tradition. We know that they proselytized, the Magi were their priests, and in the mythologized version of Christ's birth, three of them show up to look at the new god. So we know that they proselytized, and it's possible that it was the original monotheistic religion, and it influenced the heresy of Akhenaten. My friend Jose Alfredo, Gonzalez Celdrán, has written a book on the historical background for Moses, and we all know that Moses was an Egyptian, or was supposed to be Egyptian, but the myth that he was actually a Jewish woman's child and raised in the house of the pharaohs is mythologized history.
Now, isn't there a lot of evidence that he was an Egyptian pharaoh or something of that sort?
Well, Jose Alfredo's theory is that he was the brother of Akhenaten. The pharaohs had many wives, and so you could be related but not have the same mother. So he may have had some exotic mother, but he was the brother of Akhenaten, and that he espoused Akhenaten's heresy. And when Akhenaten died, Tutankhamun, who was very young and very ill, became pharaoh, and he was manipulated by the priests to renounce the heresy, and that caused Moses, who was his uncle, to take the people from the city of the sun and flee to a new promised land. The original promised land was the city of the sun that Akhenaten built. And, of course, they wandered, and so in the course of the wanderings, they intermingled with other people before they finally got to Israel. But the Jews are Egyptians, partial Egyptians, because, as I said, the pharaoh would have had wives of different nationalities.
And that would be the traditional Jews, not the Ashkenazi Jews, who would, of course, be Slavic.
Yeah. And so the idea of monotheism, which then continues on in Christianity, is originally the Persian revision of polytheism that Zoroaster brought about, demoting Mithras. Removing the polytheistic system and having one supreme god and demoting Mithras into the role of essentially the Christ, the mediator with the god. So they're the same religion, so there's many reasons why they would be the same. And since the knowledge of the mushroom seems to be ubiquitous for various reasons, but even if it were not, it comes from the same tradition the Soma, a Hauma potion, and if one version of it was a sacred mushroom, it's quite understandable why there would be a tradition of a sacred mushroom in Christianity as well as in Mithraism. So that's one reason why they're similar. And the second one is that the only way that you can destroy another religion is to build your new religion on top of the old one. And so the similarity in the sacraments of the Roman Church and the seven stages of initiation in Mithraism is just amazing because the Christians copied them. They might be archetypal, but they probably actually copied them. You can see this sort of assimilation in Athens. There's a 10th century basilica in the modern city's cathedral square. There's a 19th century huge cathedral in there, but next to it is a 10th century basilica, and it is built with stones taken from ancient temples, and not because they didn't have any other source of stone, because they're beautifully built in so you can see them. And so they're latching onto the sanctity of the temples that have been destroyed and building the new temple out of it. And the really amazing thing is that it's dedicated to the Virgin Mary, but she has an unusual epithet. She's the Gorgon, which is the old mother goddess.
Not to mention Medusa, right?
Yeah, exactly. The Medusa is the queen of the sisterhood that goes by the name of the Gorgons, her epithet is the one who hearkens to the Gorgon, which means that she probably is the queen of that sisterhood. She is the Medusa, the Gorgon Medusa.
And speaking of virgin mothers, you talk about Mithras being born on December 25th, and that in the Persian tradition, Mithras was born from the Immaculate Virgin, Anahita. Would you discuss that?
Yeah, there are two virgins. If he had a mother, she was virgin. So it's exactly like the Virgin Mary and Christ. The other tradition is that he grew out of the ground, which makes him more like a plant. And in fact, in the initiation, the whole sequence of initiations is to have that kind of second birth. And so they meet in subterranean chambers. And the final goal is to burst out of that chamber and soar to the edge of the cosmos.
I had seen another version of that story, and I was just trying to find it here, by another Iranian professor saying that, I'm trying to remember it exactly, I published that in my book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, mm-hmm. saying that, you know, the Persian god Mithra was born of a virgin mother in the year 200 and something BC, and now I'm mm-hmm. failing to find that source, though. Did you come across that same source?
Yeah, but it's not reliable because Zoroaster, we don't know what his date is, but most people would put him around the 8th century. But since anyone who became the priest in the tradition was a Zoroaster, it just means an astrologer. And so you can date him as early as before Moses, so about 1500 BC.
Yeah, this source here says that the Savior Mithra was born in the middle of the night between Saturday and Sunday, the 24th and 25th of December, 272 BCE. And according to those who believed in him, from an immaculate Anahid virgin, and he says, Xosighad, somewhere not far from Lake Haman, Sistan. He lived for 64 years among men and descended to his father, Ahura Mazda, in 208.
Mm-hmm. The date, I think, corresponds to Mani rather than Mithras. No. You're talking about BC. Mani is about the same time after the birth of Christ. Well, I mean, it's not possible. One of the difficulties in interpreting Mithraism is that there is no sacred text. There are many monuments, many works of art, but it's hard to know how to interpret them. And they also differ because they're found in the Middle East and throughout Europe, and so they have different styles. But for the most part, it's a religion that doesn't have a sacred text. But no, I would find it very difficult to believe that there's any way of dating him to a particular day and so forth. The reason that the 25th it was taken is that it's after the winter solstice, and
it's the first day of the return of the new sun.
Well, it actually the sun actually begins around the 21st or 22nd.
Well, it dies on the 21st, which is the solstice, but it's reborn on the 25th.
Well, it's by that time that you can see that it's coming back.
Right, right, exactly.
And so it's a few days off.
As the Christians would say, as the Christians would say, 3 days in the tomb, I believe.
Yeah, but well, you know, that sort of is confusing for the Christians because, I mean, Christ spent 3 days in the tomb, but he didn't spend 3 days in the tomb before he was born. He spent 3 days before. Actually, was he in the tomb 3 days?
Yeah, I believe so. But, you know, it's interesting because it's a death and resurrection story.
Yeah.
So, you know, one ends and then it sort of repeats.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's talk about the rocks and Mithraism and Christianity. How are rocks important?
Well, he's born from a rock. What does that mean?
Well, and he's also born from a virgin. So how do those two reconcile?
He's also born from a pine cone. Well, you know, you don't reconcile things in myth or religion. The way I like to explain it is that when you're telling one story, you don't hear the other. So if I want to tell you about Anahita, you're listening to that story and you're not saying, hey, what about the rock? And if I tell you about the rock, you're not saying, but what about the pine cone? They're all true. But I think that the birth from the mother is an attempt to make more believable the birth from a rock. And what would birth from a rock mean? Well, as they enacted it in the ritual, it meant that you are... Well, and Christianity has the same tradition. The birth is seen as death because the spirit is encased in matter and yearns to be free. In Renaissance art, it was very clearly seen that the Virgin Mary was a tomb from which she had to escape, and so. The series of initiations begins with the mimesis of the birth, in which the fire comes. The spirit is thirsty, and you entice it by water, a natural source of water. And so it comes and gets caught in matter. And that, unfortunately, is the worst possibility for our existence. And so what you try to do is to get rid of matter and finally to be free as a spirit and return to the home of fire, which is the fiery surround of the universe.
That almost sounds like one of the ancient Gnostic concepts as well.
They're the same thing, yes. I mean, Christianity had many versions which were later called heresies, and certainly this was a very dominant theme in Gnosticism.
Let's move into the story of the bull's blood. Where does bull's blood tie into the mushroom and the Mithraism?
Well, first of all, there's the idea that bull's blood is poisonous, that you can die by having a cup of bull's blood, and that just is not true. There's no reason why you can't drink bull's blood. And so bull's blood has to be a metaphor for something else that might cause death, like a toxin. And it's not difficult to see that plants have animate personae. One of the common animal manifestations or metaphors for the mushroom is as a bull. And so bull's blood would be the sap taken from the sacrifice bull plant.
The story of King Midas, he drank the bull's blood.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, as part of that, we speculated that, you know, he gets ass's ears. And we think that ass's ears is one of the common names for ergot. The ergots look like ass's ears.
Right. And then you were saying that you haven't found any direct textual reference to that.
No, okay.
I was just going to ask you, what do you think about Dave Nichols contesting the ergot theory still?
I don't know. There is another documentary that's being made, and they're working with Peter Webster, and they're apparently manufacturing the potion and trying it out, and to see if it works. There's no doubt that ergot has the requisite toxins. Albert Hofmann extracted LSD from ergot. It's the manner of extraction that is a problem. And it's commonly thought that if you ingest a potion of ergot, you're going to suffer from ergotism and be very ill and perhaps die. But no one has tested whether simply one dose of the potion causes visions and the side effects of ergotism don't have time to set in. Because the evidence from antiquity is that you eat it and you see something, as simple as that. I'm not sure that's true, and no one is willing to try it by eating ergot, in addition to the fact that you can't get ergot because it's a controlled substance. And
well, I suppose you could go out into a wheat field and pull the little things off of the wheat.
It's hard to do that because the grain is treated with a fungicide, so it rarely is infested with ergot, though.
Interesting. All right, well, let's change gears and talk about the Phrygian cap for a little bit here. And the Phrygian cap played a major theme throughout your book. What is the importance of the cap?
Well, it's associated with Persia, so it's the Persian cap. And it you trace where it occurs in ancient traditions, it always has the connotations of ecstatic experience, extraordinary knowledge, wizardry, and things of that kind. And then it comes to signify liberation and freedom and so forth. We think that the Phrygian cap is a metaphor for a mushroom, in fact. And the Liberty Cap mushroom is named because of its similarity to the form that the Phrygian cap had during the French Revolution and events leading up to the revolution. So it becomes associated with the quest for liberation and freedom, political. But of course, before you have political freedom, there would be the yearning for spiritual freedom. So it's the same tradition.
In your book, you mention the raven. What's the importance of the raven?
The raven is the first stage. It's when you die. Only occasionally do you get an indication in the sources of what was involved at each stage of the initiation, but there is a reference to the fact that the initiate became a raven and went around calling like a raven and so forth.
Was the raven also considered the divine word or logos?
Well, the raven gets associated with the Amanita muscaria, since raven's bread is a common name for Amanita muscaria. Ravens like to eat it.
Ravens like to eat the Amanita, really. Interesting.
Yeah. That's why it's called raven's bread, yeah.
Now, and that, as Alan Piper has discussed, and I think a couple of others, is still practiced in Afghanistan and places today. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Let's talk about the story of the bride and the nymphus. What is that all about?
Oh, I see. The second stage of the initiation, I guess, the initiate becomes the male bride. And so what does that mean? One of the authorities says it's a meaningless term because there's no such thing as a male bride. Although in Christianity, a priest is married to Christ, so he is a male bride. But Christ,
he even dresses in a dress for that matter.
In a dress, I know. But I mean, they get around it by saying that he's married to Christ in the form of the church, ecclesia, which is feminine. But the priest is married to the deity. And so that would seem to imply that the male bride stage involves some kind of sexual hazing. And we do have artwork and some written accounts that indicate that the bride either dressed as a female for this stage. He became the bride of the highest grade, which would be the pater, the father. So he dressed as a female, or was naked, in the small enclosed space of the initiation chambers. I mean, these are very small chambers, and given the fact that there would have to be some kind of enactment. There was sexual hazing, perhaps actual sodomizing of the initiate.
Well, doesn't that play into, for that matter, into the, you hear these rumors of Yale's Skull and Bones and things like that, where, you know, they possibly do these rituals and then photograph them or whatever so that people don't reveal the secrets of Skull and Bones. Is that possible?
It's possible. Of course, they didn't have cameras in antiquity. But
right, but you would have many witnesses to such acts.
So the whole point of hazing, I mean, every now and then we get information about teenagers hazing each other in clubs and things of that kind, and it's illegal, you can't do that sort of thing, and so on. But it always seems to involve having some kind of experience, which is shameful and you don't want people to know about.
Now, you've mentioned the first two stages of the initiation. What are the next five stages, if you could summarize those?
Well, I'm not sure I want to go through. I might get them wrong. Do you have the book there? So you can tell me what they are.
Oh, I would have to look them all up. I didn't write them down one by one for the notes here.
the final stage is the father. The stage before that, the sixth, is the solar chariot, in which you become essentially the Christ figure for Yahweh.
And that's the Elijah story, right?
Yeah, and Mithras with regard to Ahura Mazda. Third stage, I think, working way up, is the soldier, which in Christianity is confirmation. You become a soldier of Christ, and the ritual is very similar. Then you become a Persian, which
that's
in
the fourth.
Yeah, and then you become the lion. Now, do we have seven there? Have I left one?
Yeah, that's seven. And then the lion would be, what's the name of that lion Mithras deity?
Leontocephalic.
Yes, exactly.
God. Yeah.
Right. Okay, so that makes sense. And then he goes on from there into the last two stages.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how does astrotheology play into all of this?
And Zoroaster was an astrologer. The whole religion, the whole religion is based on an observation of the planets.
And, you know, and I know so many people out there that say that astrotheology is a complete farce when there are many, many books out there on the topic and professors that focused a lot on it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what are some of the key astrotheological themes in Mithraism?
The myth of the slaying of the bull was enacted in the precession of the equinoxes, so that the sign of the zodiac at the I guess the spring equinox solstice, I mean vernal solstice, occurs every 2,000 years in a different place. And so the religion seems to evolve at a time when you have the constellation Taurus. And it moves on. 2,000 years later, you get to the constellation of the Ram, which many people interpret as something that the Christians interpreted as the sacrifice of the Lamb. As you know, we've moved another 2,000 years on, and we're now in or about to be in Aquarius.
Now, what's interesting is the Jews blow the shofar, the ram's horn, and that religion also started about the same time as Aries did. You know, and we talked about all of this in our book, Astrotheology and Shamanism, as well. You know, and I find that, you know, you go into a lot more depth on some of this stuff than we did in that book. So it's really interesting to see all of this coming out and being incorporated into, you know, into the newer academic work coming out, because it's something that really needed to be combined, both the astrotheology and the entheogenic research for decades now.
Yeah, well, my latest work is on medieval and Renaissance art, focusing on, in particular, the Van Eyck altarpiece, the Ghent altarpiece. And what I argue is that...
Well, I think that was a paper that a friend of both of ours had sent to both of us. Is that correct?
Yeah. I worked with him, and then he found it was going to be too dangerous, and so he dropped out of the project, and I concluded it with Mark.
He also, interestingly, gave that to me to work on as well.
Yeah,
so
I know he told me that he had approached you with it also. He doesn't want to be involved in any of this. So we do have a mention of him, but you'd never know that he was he began as a co-author of the whole work.
Right.
But this goes beyond what he was doing anyway, because I worked on it for another couple of years after he dropped out. But a work of art is meant to call down the forces of the cosmos and manipulate it and play it back. In alchemy, there's not only the idea that you are observe the heavens, and they have an effect upon human life, but you can rearrange symbols here in human life or through alchemy, and by doing that, you change the cosmos. And I discovered that this is a very, very ancient idea in the Etruscans in about 600 BC in the Italian peninsula. And they were merely continuing traditions that go back to Mesopotamia, but they were great at inspecting the liver of a sacrificed animal, because it had indications of the cosmos, and so they could foretell the future by inspecting the liver. They also could make a prognosis about the state of the universe, but in addition to that, they could, but we all know, they could change the cosmos. So you could actually, by moving, if what's above is what's below, what's above will influence what's below, but it goes the other way around. You move around the significant things below, and it changes what's above.
Interesting. Yeah, we talked about a lot of this. In fact, the first title of Astrotheology and Shamanism, the subtitle was Unveiling the Law of Duality in Christianity and Other Religions, which was all about the as above and so below.
Yes, exactly. Of course, I've read your book many times.
Oh, you have?
I'm not uninfluenced by Jung.
So who in the mythology here is Sol?
Being the sun?
Well, in regards to Mithras in your book.
Well, in the stages of initiation, it would be the pater.
The what?
The father, the seventh stage. And the stage beneath him is the one who drives the solar chariot. And the fate of the solar charioteer is to fall. And in his fall, occasion the collapse of the cosmos, so it can begin all over again. And this is not something that you're afraid of. It's something you want to happen. You want the cosmos to start all over again.
Interesting. All right. So, what was the bull meat?
Bull meat has to be a metaphor for a psychoactive sacrament, as we argue. It can't have been bull meat, because you can't slaughter a bull unless you're trained. And so a typical Mithraic Brotherhood had only about 30 people in it. It's unlikely that each one had a butcher. So you need a butcher in order to kill a bull. Bulls don't like to be killed anyway. But then you have to have someone who knows how to cut up the meat. And then, in addition to that, they couldn't have killed the bull in the small chamber. Bulls are wild animals, and it'd be impossible in a small room to have a bull. And,
in a small Mithraeum.
Yeah, and that you could slaughter him. And if you did manage to do it, when you slaughter a bull, you have a tremendous flood of blood. And so the place would be absolutely horrible. In addition to that, when you slaughter a bull, you have food for about 100 people and or more. Certainly too much food to for 30 people to have. And in addition to that, you can't cook it underground. So it just doesn't work out. It's not bulls that they're eating. It's not bulls that they're slaughtering. It's a metaphor. And bull's blood, bull's meat, those are all metaphors for the sacrament. Various sacraments involved. We strongly believe that cannabis was part of it. The chamber was probably always fumigated with cannabis, so that entering it puts you in a heightened visionary state in the first place. The ultimate sacrament, whether only metaphorically or in actuality, would have to be the mushroom's association with the bull.
What does Mithras mean in Farsi?
Mediator.
Mediator. And you also have love, son, and friend listed in your book.
Yeah. But you see, Christ, that's exactly what Christ is. He's a mediator with Yahweh. Yahweh is unapproachable. You can't have a relationship with him. You need someone who is, and Yahweh is faceless.
Well, isn't Yahweh also like a war god as well?
Yeah, they're always war gods, yeah. But you can't have a relationship with a deity that has no face. And the reason Christ has a face is that this is a religion that was proselytized to the Hellenized world, and so Christ is actually a Greek hero. It's the pattern of Greek religion to conceive of the deity in human form, and that is not a lesser form of religion. It means that you can have a relationship with that female or that man, because in some way they share your humanity, which is exactly what Christ does. He shares humanity by the incarnation. And so through him, you can mediate with the faceless great one.
Okay, and you also mentioned that Mithra was called the victorious Shoshyant, which means Messiah, or quote-unquote, when the dead rise again, when the living become immortal, life will make life glorious.
Yeah. That's true. I said that, yeah.
It's there. Well, what can you tell us about this whole idea of Mithra being the Messiah, just like in Christianity? Well, obviously, you know, I'm just leading the question here, but it's obvious to me and to you as well that we're looking at really an amalgamation of what's really the same religion, just an older and newer version of the same mythology.
Yeah, it's the same religion.
You state that the Greek magical papyri identifies the bull's shank as the constellation of the Little Bear or Ursa Minor. Would you tell us more about that?
I don't think I know more about it than that, but that's what it does. it's the configuration that turns around the pole star, and so it leads you to the hole in the cosmos through which you can drop to or ascend to another universe. It's always amazing the way constellations are put together to describe a particular configuration, because they don't really very often look like what they're supposed to be a picture of. But it's obvious that what humans are doing is projecting their own metaphor upon an ambiguous structure in the sky.
And let's return to the bread for a minute. We already talked about the raven's bread. You also talk about the bread that's incised with the Greek chi, indicative of the crossing of the celestial equator and the zodiacal elliptic.
Yeah.
How does bread play into both Mithraism and Christianity? And obviously in many of these Christian paintings, we see this same X on the bread that you see in Mithraism.
Yeah. Well, we have a passage in the book where we describe the symbolism of bread, the fact that it is an analog of the cosmos. The whole cosmos was made in the same way that a bread heaves up with the yeast. And so heaven is what is heaved up. So the cosmos formed by this fermenting process, pushing out to the outer limits. You see the same. They could see what's happening in the fermenting of a loaf of bread, in the way they conceive the entire cosmos. And of course, the fermenting of bread is caused by yeast, and yeast is a mushroom. So it's the same structure that you have in the growth of a mushroom. Bread and mushrooms are very similar in that they're made mostly of empty space.
Well, not only that, but yeast is a type of fungus that would make
exactly.
bread active.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they both have this sponge look, which is where the word fungus comes from.
Exactly, yes. Yes, fungus is fungus, which is sponge.
Is there any relation to the word of bread for sponge?
I haven't looked into it. I don't know.
How do opposites become complements in the higher mysteries?
That's the goal of all meditation, all transcendent thought, to realize that the world in which you live is one configuration that exists only because it's cast its opposite possibility. And when you reach the point where the two come together, you've attained what you're seeking. You can put it any way you want. You realize that life and death are the same thing, that male and female are the same thing, that everything you thought was one thing because it wasn't the other. The truth is that the other was always part of its opposite, and it's only by ceasing to create the universe in oppositional forms that you achieve the transcendent state.
Now, is that sort of like the Hegelian dialectic? And it's well known that Hegel was a hermeticist. Would that relate at all?
I think so, yeah.
Interesting.
You know that there's a conference in Thrace. I was hoping to go to it end of October on the mushroom stones of Thrace.
I did get your invitation, but unfortunately it appears that money will be the primary resistant factor there.
But, I mean, who knew that Thrace, which is where many of these ecstatic religions came from, into Greece and into the Roman Empire, that Thrace has a great number of natural stone formations which look like mushrooms, and they you can archaeologically you can discover that they were sacred spots. Sometimes the natural formation has been modified to make it look more like a mushroom too, and then in addition to that there are a great number of stone slabs which have mushrooms incised on them. Now I haven't seen these things, but as part of our conference activity, we're going to be taking a tour of them.
Fascinating. Well, if I don't make it, I'd love to see some photos of that stuff on your return.
Yeah.
Where did Mithraism originate?
It came out of Persia.
Well, you mentioned the Stoics and things like that in the book. How do they all tie in?
Stoicism is a philosophical form it took in the Roman Empire, but the philosophy in the Roman Empire that we would call the religion of Zoroaster is Stoicism, and most people think a Stoic is someone who just accepts things the way they are, nothing you can do about it. But actually, the goal of the Stoic is to reach that point of enlightenment so that you understand why things are the way they are. It's not that you accept it, it's that you see the total pattern of the universe.
Let's go back to some of the other constellations and how they play into Mithraism. Why does the scorpion or Scorpio grab or pinch the bull's testicles?
I don't think we were really able to explain every aspect of the symbolism, but why a scorpion? And perhaps it has to do with the configuration in the skies.
And how is Mithras inside the cosmic cave, and how does that relate to the Mithraeum?
Mithraeum is the cave, and the cave is the enclosed death in the incarnation.
So the cave is like a microcosm of the cosmic sky.
Yeah, it's a metaphor for the incarnation. They enacted it, but it's what it is to have the celestial fire encased in matter. And the goal of the religion is to burst out of that cosmic cave back to the cosmos.
And are you able to relate how Mithraism ties back to the Seoma or the Soma and Heoma cults?
Oh, Heoma cults. Yeah, I think so. Because it goes back. It essentially is a religion of warrior brotherhoods. And it's the religion of the Persian kings and his army, his chosen elite army.
But how does that tie back to, say, Soma and what we know of the Soma ideas from you and Wasson and David Flattery and Chris Bennett?
Yeah. Well, you were talking about Anahita before, and I said, well, that's one way of telling the story.
Here, let's wait till your clocks are finished there.
Okay.
All right. Go ahead.
His birth from a female is one way of telling the story, but that really is not what Mithraism has as its major philosophy. The philosophy is that being born from a female would be disaster. What you want to do is to avoid the encasement in flesh And so it's a very, I mean, it's for this reason that the religion is only for men, which is probably one of the reasons why it lost out to Christianity, because half of the populace is female, and there's nothing for a female to do in Mithraism. So it's very similar to Plato and Neoplatonism, that the higher form of procreation is thought, which involves men with men, but the superior child.
It's interesting that you would say that. You know, Jack Herer, the father of the hemp movement, for years he was working on a book called The Most High regarding John Allegro's work in the mushroom theory, and he often argued that what these priests would do is they would get in these circles having anal intercourse with each other, and then the lead priest would have sex with a virgin who would then conceive God children. Have you ever heard of that?
Not precisely that way, but I've heard similar things, yeah.
So that's not out of the ordinary from what you've studied from these things?
No, I mean for actual procreation, you probably do need a female. Marguerite Rigoglioso has a theory that you don't need a male.
Right, and I've had her on my show a couple of times discussing that.
I spoke to her on the phone, and it's very interesting, and maybe it's possible. David Hillman thinks it might be possible, manipulating serpent venoms and so forth, but it would have a very rare sort of occasion. But for the most part, you do need an egg and a sperm. But she does talk about rituals where the spirit of the deity is called to reside in the man, physical man, who then copulates with the female, so that she isn't copulating with the man, she's copulating with the god.
Interesting.
You know, you talk about John Allegro, and I meant to tell you somewhere along the way that I bought a really attractive book on the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was offered by the History Book Club, and it is very attractive, and lots of pictures and so forth. The text is very boring, but and they do have pictures of John Allegro. And this is the definitive summation, the common reader, what the Dead Sea Scrolls are all about. And I came away from it not really knowing what they're about at all. But I was amazed that there is no mention anywhere of the controversy caused by John Allegro's theory. Nothing at all, nothing. You should mention it and refute it, but just no mention at all. John Allegro was just, you know, just like all the rest of them doing his job, and everything was fine.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Well, a couple of years ago, I went to the San Diego Museum and saw the Dead Sea Scrolls there. Mm-hmm. And they have this whole big thing, all of this display about the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then they had one photograph of John Allegro sitting at a table with some other guys. And then they just put, and then they mentioned the other guys, and they put, and John Allegro. And that was the only mention of the guy in the entire thing. It wasn't, you know. He wasn't one of the key members. He didn't, you know, he wasn't the one who brought attention to the scrolls. He wasn't the one who brought money in so that they could even be deciphered and stored. And he was obviously the one who did all of that work.
Yeah, I know.
So it's really frustrating how history is still treating Allegro, but
done our best.
You know, and I'm going to give you a little bit of a hard time, because in my In my 2008 interview with you at your home, you said that in Apples of Apollo, you have a footnote saying that, you know, Allegro's work needs to be reexamined, but you omitted him from the bibliography because alphabetically he would have been first. So I'm going to give you a hard time. How come you didn't put me in the bibliography when you cite some of my work?
I don't know. It wasn't conscious. We had a show and tell meeting with the graduate students a couple of weeks ago, and it was a stupid idea, but we were all supposed to make a very short statement about what our work was. And for the most part, graduate students aren't allowed to work with me because it's too dangerous.
Yeah, you and I have talked about that a lot in the past.
And so I said, well, I made up the word entheogen in order to make the subject of my inquiries less toxic. And everyone laughed.
And that's true. And you know, 30 years on, I do give you full credit for that rather than Wasson and Odd and Jeremy Beckman.
Yeah, we put everyone's name together. So they would, but I'm the one who made it up, yeah.
Sure, and it's just like the Road to Ulysses book. I know full well that you're the real author of that book.
Yeah.
But anyway, let's go back to Christianity. You say that Christianity was the greatest benefactor of Mithraism. How's that so?
It took over the world because the Roman Empire had an empire administered by the Mithraic warriors and bureaucrats. And all you needed was the conversion of the emperor to Christianity. And so they had a whole empire converted, just like that, you know, the signing of a document. And many people think that Constantine never converted. He was a Mithraist.
Sure.
And it was just convenient to rule an empire, to have a single temporal ruler who was the agent for a single celestial ruler. So it was a good idea. His mother, who was an Asiatic, she was apparently truly a Christian, St. Helena. But Constantine probably never really was a Christian.
I would agree with that. And in fact, there's evidence that, was it Constantine was actually who the story of Jesus was based on?
Yeah, there's that theory, yes.
So are you saying, Carl, that Christianity is not the origin of many of these stories? Isn't that heretical?
Well, I am toxic.
All right. So, and how did the Orthodox Church perpetuate Mithraism?
The Orthodox Church preserves some very ancient aspects that the Roman Church has outlawed, and it's probably because their topographical location put them in contact with Mesopotamia and places where these heresies were flourishing, and so they have some very, very interesting traditions that don't survive in the Roman Church.
What is the meaning of the orb surmounted by the cross, the globus cruciger?
Well, everything has multiple meanings. It's the sign for a chemical. Antimony, I think. It's also descriptive of sexual organs together, and but it probably means the round universe, the Empyrean, with the cross where the solar ecliptic and the projection of the equator cross.
The ecliptic with the equinox and the solstice, you mean,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, probably, yeah.
Now, and then this would obviously tie back down, going back down to the microcosm, to the bread being marked with the same cross, correct?
Yeah.
And on page 212, you mention some stuff that I had sent you regarding the sed vacante being related to the mushroom. And I had sent you pictures that someone had sent from me from Rome back. I think I sent you that in 2008, which you cited there. Tell us the significance of the sed vacante.
I'm not hearing the word sebaconte. What is
The period between popes. I'm probably slaughtering the Latin. Okay, yeah. Pronounce the proper Latin and correct.
Yeah. Sebaconte. Yeah.
Thank you.
During the period when the seat is not occupied, the interregnum.
What is the significance of that symbol?
Well, I think I went along with you that it seems to be suggestive of a mushroom, didn't I?
Yeah, I think. Well, I was just—I thought you had found even more information on it than I had, and I was trying to drag that out of you, but I guess it didn't work. Let's discuss the Freemasons. How do they connect into all of this? Pretty much the entire end of your book is about the Freemasons.
Yeah, we think that Mithraism never died. It just went underground. The problem with secret societies is they keep secrets, and so it's hard to have anything except suspicions.
Have you been initiated into any societies yourself?
No, but we have people who've been acting as spies. The problem is that you have to learn all of this phony stuff and take your exams and so forth before they let you advance. But we do have spies that are doing that. But I don't. I really can't see myself doing that. Discovering that the Brotherhoods of Knights in the medieval period, Renaissance, the Knights Templar, and so forth, they were perpetuating warrior brotherhoods, and the big warrior brotherhood was the one of Mithras in the Roman Empire. So that it never died out. We have that Mithraic tomb of the Spanish bishop, and this is well within the Christian period, but he seems to have been a Mithraist too. And so one way that it survives is in secret societies, in the big secret society, that probably came, they don't want you to know the history of these things, and so there are phony stories, and there's so much controversy. But Freemasonry probably is a continuation of the Knights Templar. And so they are perpetuating. They may not know what the symbolism means anymore, although all they do is study the symbolism. But it's the Mithraic pattern. And our informants tell us that there are secrets. They like to say that the Masons are not a secret society. Skull and Bones is a secret society, which means that you can't know who belongs to it. But there are societies.
Unless you know Charlotte Iserbeat's work, and then.
Yeah. they say that they're a society with secrets. And most of the people who are initiated as Freemasons don't get to know the highest secrets. But we have informants that are telling us things about the highest secrets, which brings us back to the Mithraic sacrament.
Have you betrayed the ancient secrets?
Well, by saying this much, I guess I am. It's hard. The interesting thing is, if that's the case, which high Masons knew or didn't know the secret? And everybody knows that Lafayette and George Washington were high-degree Masons. Was Washington high enough to have the secret?
Well, all of Washington, D.C. is laid out on ancient sacred geometry from the Quadrivium.
And Dan Brown's latest book is based on that exactly.
Yeah, well, there's a lot better research than Dan Brown's.
what he does, of course, is use the research in order to fictionalize it, but there's nothing wrong with that.
You know what, Carl, are you familiar with the Trivium and Quadrivium and how they were originally taught?
You've written about that, but so you could tell me more about it. I can't remember what you said.
Yeah. Actually, I've done a lot of work on it lately. One day we'll have to sit down, but that's a huge part of the ancient mysteries, too, that I've stumbled upon lately. And just to, I think we're just about wrapping up here. I have a couple more things. Did you have anything that you wanted to add specifically that we didn't cover regarding your new book?
I think we've had a really good conversation.
Let me ask you, Hank Albarelli, who wrote the massive tome on the Frank Olson murder called A Terrible Mistake, announced recently that he has a new book coming out. He said in November that will reveal new evidence from the Freedom of Information Act that somehow Wasson had connections to the JFK assassination. Supposedly, the information is from the CIA and other sources. Have you heard anything about this?
No, I haven't.
And I've seen firsthand documentation that Wasson had connections to the intelligence community. Did he ever discuss his roles with the government or Council on Foreign Relations with you?
No, he didn't. But it's hard to know how much these things are true. You probably are aware of somebody has just revealed that there were secret societies in Germany that were actively seeking psychoactive substances, and that they had discovered LSD.
Interesting.
And I don't know if this is true or not, but and that Albert Hoffman was part of this group.
Right.
And they decided to keep it a secret, and then they realized that the world was going so bad because of Nazism, maybe it would help to reveal the secret. And so the claim is that the bicycle ride is a fiction.
Right.
So you know this. But I don't know.
Oh, yeah, well, I know. I
don't know if I believe it or not, because I mean, I knew Albert, and I can't believe that he kept the secret so well. So the same thing is true about Watson. I wouldn't know.
You know that Albarelli published primary documents in his book, A Terrible Mistake, that showed that Hoffman was both CIA and French intelligence.
Yeah.
And he also, and I also found, have you read B.H. Friedman's book, Tripping, that came out just in the last couple of years? But he mentions in there that that Wasson was actually a director of Sandoz for J.P. Morgan Bank.
No, I didn't know that. But, I mean, this story about Albert Hoffman I find totally fantastic, except for the fact that Alan Piper independently has been looking into the knowledge of the occult in the end of the 19th century in elite societies, and he's been coming upon indications that Albert should have known about LSD from people who've written novels and things of that kind.
Now, what about the big secret club that these guys were all involved with, the Century Club? Did Wasson ever talk to you about that?
No. I know that he belonged to it. I know that he brought Jonathan out there for lunch, and he had to have a tie, but they had a tie to put on Jonathan so he could go. So I know he was a member of it, but no, I don't know anything about it. I never went.
What is the single most important concept that you would like people to take away from your third interview here with Gnostic Media?
Well, I think I would like them to reconsider the rejection of John Oliva's work, because it looks as though there was a thriving mushroom cult in many cultures going back to prehistory, and there's no reason why it wasn't thriving in Judaism, and it looks as though it continued on in many other religions, including Christianity.
And would you please
the elite of history have had their secrets.
Indeed they have. And you know what I find interesting, and we just mentioned the Trivium and Quadrivium a bit ago, is the Trivium is how they maintain all of their secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And taking the Trivium is grammar, logic, and rhetoric, always taught in that specific order. And what they do is they teach them as individual subjects or out of order, and then that handicaps the person being taught the information.
Have you ever interviewed Dan Mercure?
I have, yes.
Because, I mean, he knows about how the Hermetic writings, rearrange things so that you can understand them unless you know how to put them back in the right order.
All right. Would you please give us your book titles and any other information that you'd like the audience to have?
Well, the latest book by City Lights Press is Mushrooms, Myths, and Mithras, the drug cult that civilized Europe. The book that's coming out from Carolina Academic Press is The Effluence of Deity, Psychoactive Sacraments in Alchemy, Alchemical Psychoactive Sacraments in Medieval and Renaissance Art. There's a paper that's coming out in John Rush's book that he's putting together for next year. It has to do with the use of psychoactive sacraments in religion in order to produce political action. And so I have an interesting paper that he likes that has to do with drugs and the Dionysian agenda, I think, or something like that. Yeah, well, I'm not sure what I was going to say. That's not the title. I can't remember what it is, but it's something like that.
Well, it's a good conclusion for our talk because John Rush was on the show last week and had another great interview with us. And he always ruffles people's feathers like you do, so that's always good. Did you want to mention your earlier books?
Oh, you know, if you Google me, you'll find me. since I'm a university faculty, you look me up via the university and you get my complete curriculum vitae.
And you've written, what, about 10 books now?
Yeah.
Including your language books? All right, Carl, thank you so much for taking the time for this interview.
Yeah,
I really appreciate it.
I wish I would be seeing you in Thrace, but anyway.
Well, you know what? Maybe the audience, after hearing this talk, will figure out a way to get me there, and maybe I will see you. Maybe there will be a miracle.
Okay.
All right, Carl, it was great talking to you again.
To you. Yeah.
All right, bye. Have a great day. Bye-bye.